You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with a voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Prock, the presenter of the Prock Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. Welcome to the Friday edition of the Prock Pop Show. I'm your host, Raymond Thomas Prock, and today I'm going to be covering War and Peace because I think we were maybe on the verge of another war, and that's sad. Now, I have good news. The good news, it's really not going to really start until after the November elections. In other words, you're not going to see much military action in Iraq. Some, yes, but a lot, no. And I think our president has made very, very clear. Well, let's just say clear. He does not want boots on the ground. Is that clear? No boots on the ground. What about flip-flops? What about sneakers? What about just regular leather shoes? Okay or not? No boots on the ground. Have you heard that phrase before? It usually makes it at least once a day in one of his speeches or campaign trips. No boots on the ground. The second part, and I call that again, our footwear foreign policy. Now, what does he mean by that? And I think most people understand what he means. He does not want to send the U.S. military, that's the Army, Marines, Navy, Air Force, into Iraq again. And that's understandable because he was against George Bush sending or starting the war with Iraq to bring down Saddam Hussein, find all those weapons of mass destruction. And we were terrifically successful. That needs to be said for the first 6 months. For the first six months, the Iraqi people loved us because we brought down a brutal dictator. And we did. And we're heroes, and the people loved us. It was terrific if you're in the military there for the first 6 months. But what happened? In the next 6 months, in the next year, two, three, 4 years, they increasingly resented us at first because they began to see us as occupiers. And we had an occupying army. And we would patrol the roads, the neighborhoods, and we could rough people up. And we did. We could break into houses, and we did. Looking for people that were in the Saddam Hussein's regime. And remember, Saddam Hussein was Sunni. But here's the important point. He ran a secular regime, a dictatorship, a brutal dictatorship, but he tried to keep the peace. He killed his enemies, tortured many, many people, families. He wasn't a nice guy, and he deserved killing, and eventually we caught him, and we executed him, we hung him, broke his neck, and now he's dead and buried. Well, what happened, though? Remember, the United States military can win any war. The problem is not winning a war in the sense of defeating another military force. I believe there's not a military force on this earth that the United States military could not defeat in a conventional, and let me underline that, in a conventional war. In other words, tanks against tanks, Air Force against Air Force, Navy against Navy. No doubts about it. It's expensive to do that. It's going to cost you billions of dollars, depending on what the opposing forces are. But we can win it. Win it in the sense of destroying the military capability of that nation. In this case, Iraq. And we did. We won it quicker than anyone thought. we could do it faster, easier, cheaper, and we did. But then what are you going to do? And that's the important point. Then what are you going to do? How are you going to win the peace? You can win the war, but how do you win the peace? And if you're going to go to war, you need a strategy of winning the peace. The U.S. military, whether it's the Navy, the Air Force fighters, your armor, as well as infantry, whether it's the Army, the Marines, are very professional and very proficient at winning wars. And they have mainly people that are young, very motivated, pardon the expression, want to kick ass, and they do it and they win. But then what happens? And it happened in Iraq, and now it's happening again in Iraq. The people slowly but surely resent the Americans, the occupiers, the ugly Americans. Because what happens, this military force that can beat anyone is continually being present in the neighborhoods, patrolling, and eventually, it might be 6 months, it might be a year, it might be several years, the natives, the Iraqis in this case, start to fight back. Initially, it might just be fights, but eventually it's violence where people are shooting at you, snipers are shooting at you. If they can get their hands on explosives, they make bombs, and when you go on patrol, they blow the bombs up, and they get very, very good at it. Initially, they're not very good at it, but over time, they get very, very good at it, very proficient. They know how to hide them. They know how to set them off, and what happens? More and more Americans are killed, more and more Americans are wounded, and what is happening back in the United States? The American people, slowly but surely, are demanding to bring the troops home. Now, that's why I recommend, before you go to war, before any president puts the American armed forces in harm's way, that a declaration of war be declared, as is required under the Constitution of the United States, that Congress is the only one that has the power to declare war. The president can ask for it, and then there should be a national conversation, a debate, if you will, to see whether or not the United States will declare war. Unfortunately, rarely does Congress do that, and the president ask. We've had over 50 instances where the president, as commander-in-chief, has ordered our armed forces to go to war, invade countries. Some have been successful, some have not been successful. We win them, and if we get out fast, we don't incur the cost of the revenge or the resentment resulting in snipers, for example, trying to kill you or bombs going off, and eventually an insurgency against you. Now, the military is prepared today to fight a nuclear war and a conventional war. And they're very good at it. They're very professional. And those are what one thinker has called the Leviathan force. Those are the big assets, whether it's ships, aircraft carriers, cruisers, destroyers, armored divisions, the paratroopers, jet fighters, bombers, submarines. All of that is to deliver both a nuclear or conventional war. And most nations, I would say almost all nations, know that if you attack the United States, if you were foolish enough to do that, you will wake the giant and he'll come and kill you. So guess what? Nations don't attack the United States. It's not a very wise decision. Now, that doesn't mean they don't kill your sons and daughters. They most definitely do. And this week we had an example of the murder or execution by beheading of an American journalist, photojournalist Foley, by the Islamic State, formerly ISIS. And let me say at least two things on that, or maybe three. ISIS, if you listen to television, listen to radio, they'll say ISIS, 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 ISIS. And ISIS stands for the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. It was a group of jihadists that want to fight a holy war against the infidels. In other words, people that are not of the Sunni, or not Islamic Sunnis. not that branch of Islam. In other words, if you don't believe or have the same faith or religion as them, they want to kill you. They're fanatics, folks. You don't want to run into them. Because if they get a hold of you and you don't pay a ransom, and this group was asking initially for a very, very high ransom that wasn't paid, they will kill you. I have no doubts about it. But don't feel they're picking on you. They don't like Americans. They don't like Europeans. They don't like Christians. They don't like Jews. They don't like Hindus. They don't like Buddhists. And although they're Sunni, the branch of Islam, that's the majority, they don't like the Shia. They want to kill them. These guys are killers. And they're leading an insurgent army, a terrorist army, today in both Iraq and Syria. Now, there's a fairly broad range of estimates. I have no idea, and I suspect neither does Department of Defense, as to how many people are in the Army. I've seen a number of estimates, typically between 15,000 to 50,000. Now, the hardcore of this Army, probably 20 or 30%, are the true believers. They're the ones you definitely don't want to be captured by, because they might just kill you on the spot. And there are videos on YouTube showing that. The rest, probably 70, 80%, have joined this army, many out of fear of these people and coercion, like a press gang being drafted, where if you don't join, you might get killed. So many young men of fighting age, if you will, have joined what on television was called ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq, and that was their former name. But today they've shortened it. They've rebranded their group's name to Islamic State. You're gonna see and hear both names, and I'm trying to make it real clear what they're called. I think it's very important to be accurate and describe how they want to be called. And on June 29th of this year, they hold the equivalent of a press conference to announce the name change and the fact that they were going to establish a caliphate, think of it as an empire, headed by a caliph. And the caliph is Baghdadi. You'll probably hear that name and have seen some pictures, and there's some information on YouTube. And before I forget, the way you listen to my show is to go to the pronkpops.wordpress.com site. Let me say that a little slower. That's pronkpops, P-R-O-N-K-P-O-P-S .wordpress.com. And if you do, at the very top, you have links to my most recent 60 to 80 shows. At the very bottom, you'll have links to the entire portfolio of the Pronk Pop Show, with the exception of some of the earlier shows that were accidentally overwritten. So they're lost to posterity. I don't think it's a great loss, because I was doing a weekly show at the time and I was new to it. I've gotten, I think, a lot better. I'll say so myself, a lot better. But that's why I do the show every day now. I want to take it to a much higher level. Hopefully by the end of this semester, sometime in December, I will be at even a higher level. That's my plans, and I hope to execute my plans. Not kill my plans, execute. In other words, deliver the goods, get the results. So go to the pronkpops.wordpress.com site to listen to the show. But more importantly, I have what I call my show preparation, show prep, what they call it in talk radio. And it usually consists of a number of videos, graphics for this. For example, for this show, I have a map of Iraq, Syria, and the surrounding countries, so you get an idea, because most of you probably can't point to Iraq on a map. I certainly couldn't until I prepared for the show. I know roughly where it is, and I deliberately picked this show because I truly believe they're not going to declare a war, but the nation is going to go to war. I would even say the nation is already at war, and other undeclared war. But our president, Barack Obama, we only have one. However, his time is getting increasingly short. Praise the Lord, because I think he's been a failure in terms of economic policy and a big failure in terms of foreign policy. Both are very, very bad, and both are getting worse. That's what happens if you elect a president that simply did not have the experience and the skill set to do or perform a very, very challenging job. I would say the office of the president, and as well as his other role as commander-in-chief, is probably one of the most difficult jobs anyone can have. Many orders of magnitude difficult in terms of difficulty compared to any other job. No one gets elected president and is truly prepared for the job. Many grow in the job, many do not. Now, you need to understand, we have a president that is fairly articulate. He is very, very good at reading a script off a teleprompter. And that's a skill that, on occasion, I've done, but it takes practice. Practice makes perfect. And the more you practice, and the president has practiced an awful lot, he is very, very, very good today reading a speech. And he's also, to his credit, actually gotten better answering questions, talking on his feet. But he's not a great orator in the sense of someone that can talk to an audience and grab them without a teleprompter and without questions being asked. In other words, without a script. For example, I don't have any paper or script in front of me. This is entirely spontaneous. Not many people can do that. In commercial talk radio, or for that matter, what I'm doing here, I'm basically practicing, folks. I'm trying to sharpen my public speaking, broadcasting, my communication skills. And the only way you get better is practice, practice, practice. And to really master it, you have to have upwards of 10,000 hours. The so-called 10,000-hour rule, which I believe in. And I don't know exactly how many hours I've been doing this. Several thousand, by the way. And the reason why I say that, I have to do show prep. I look at a lot of material. I read a lot of material. I listen to a lot of material. If time permits, I'll write articles. For example, on this subject, I have written an article, and this Sunday I have to write another article, part two. I believe I have to. We'll see. And I want to get into that. But we have a president that is a good communicator. The problem is not communication. The problem is his policies and his advisors that are presenting the policy options to him and the options he selected. We are literally on the verge of another recession. Unemployment is very high. It's over 6%. And I'm not sure if it's this Friday. It's either this coming Friday or the following Friday. I'll be giving my unemployment update and more or less my views of where the economy stands, because we will be getting the second estimate on what the gross domestic product, GDP, did for the second quarter. Remember, if you believe government statistics, which I don't, the economy grew at 4%, which is very, very good, but that's the advanced estimate, and really it's based on incomplete information. And what I've warned people, take that first advance estimate with a large grain of salt, actually with a barrel of salt, because invariably it's going to be changed, sometimes upwards, but usually downwards, and I think this estimate will drop accordingly. 3%, 2%, I don't know. I don't make guesses. Let the government tell us, and it will in the end of August, what it is. And I'm not looking forward to it, because I think it's going to be, my guess is the final estimate, which we won't get until the end of September, third revised estimate, somewhere between 1% and 2%. I'm not going to pinpoint that, but that's my educated guess. I don't think it's going to be at 4. It could be at 3 and then subsequently drop down to 2. So I'm going to be very, very interested in and going to report on that and see what the impact on the employment situation is. Because literally every day Barack Obama has been in office, the unemployment rate has been above 6%. And for over half the time, it's been over 8, 9%. That's not good. Near full employment, you get a debate amongst economists on this, is about 3%. Some would say 4, or between 3 and 4. I call near full employment rate as under 3%, either 3% or 2.9. We're more than double that, and that's the problem. People are still finding difficulties finding a full-time job. They're searching. Many people are taking a part-time job. But I'm digressing. I'm just giving you a heads up. In the next week, maybe 2 weeks, I will definitely give you a update on my thoughts, my comments, my views as to where the economy is, as well as what the employment situation is. And if you listen to the past show, I think we're literally on the brink. We're at or about to tip over and go into another recession. I hope it doesn't happen. I truly do hope it doesn't happen, because there are many, many people, many families out there that are truly hurting. Now, let's get back to the war and peace issue. The story this week was that execution. And why did the Islamic State murder or execute this photojournalist? And yes, you can go on YouTube. I don't recommend it. I haven't looked at it. I've already been warned. It probably will give you nightmares. I've seen some brutal killings and beheadings, but once you see one, you usually don't want to see another. There's some people, they rush to see it. And remember, at one time, hangings, executions were public in the United States and Great Britain. We don't do that anymore. Some would say we should. I don't really have a view on that. I'm not totally convinced capital punishment is a deterrent, but to the extent people are taking other people's lives, I think they should forfeit their own, even though I'm very much pro-life. In other words, don't commit the crime. Don't commit the crime of homicide, for example, where someone else's life is snuffed out, ended, because you did it. The Islamic State executed, murdered an American photojournalist that they captured in Syria, I think, going on 2 years ago. You see, the Islamic State used to be called, before the name changes, up until 2006, it used to be called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Now, what happened to Al-Qaeda in Iraq? The first 4 years, 3 to 4 years of the United States war in Iraq, 2003 to through 2006, they didn't go that well. We got the first 6 months, first 6 months went terrifically, and we defeated in a conventional war the Army of Iraq. But then over time, what developed? An insurgency. In other words, they were waging not a conventional warfare. They don't have the arms. When you don't have tanks, jets, helicopters, bombers, artillery, in other words, you're way outgunned, and virtually every nation is outgunned when compared to the United States, you have to improvise. You have to have ambushes. You have to have bombs if your goal is to attack the occupying forces, which in this case was the United States Army and Marines. It doesn't really matter if you come in as liberators and are perceived as liberators, because it's only a matter of time before that perception is going to change. People will naturally resent foreigners no matter where they're from, especially if they're well-armed, they're intimidating, and they're continually patrolling your area. And what eventually happens, you do have ambushes, you have bombs going off, and that's exactly what happened. Now, what makes Iraq a very an explosive situation is the fact you have, first of all, a Shiite or Shia majority in terms of the population. In other words, they are Arabs, but they are of the Shia branch of Islam, which is actually a minority in terms of the total numbers of people that are of the profess the Islamic faith. I've seen different estimates, but about 89% roughly. I've seen them a little higher, a little lower, but about 89% are Sunni. The other 11, 12, maybe 10, who knows, are Shia. So you need to understand, in Iraq, it's the Shia that control most of southern, from about the middle, central part of the country, down to Basra, near the southern tip where the oil is. The oil's in Basra. And that's very rich farmland. But it's a very much mixed neighborhood, but the Shia predominate. But you have neighborhoods that are predominantly Sunni, and others that are primary Shia. Well, what happened after Saddam Hussein's regime was overthrown, and he eventually was executed. Former members of that regime started to fight back. Remember, they had a good paying job. They had a government job, whether it's in the army or one of the government bureaucracies, ministries. Suddenly, they can't find work, or many of them can't find work. They're not kept on by the United States government, so they need to support their family. And some of them start attacking U.S. forces in Iraq. And they know what they're doing because they're former military. They've had some practice at it. But that was only really the start of the problem. Also, what happened? The U.S. forces in Iraq started to attract Al-Qaeda. And the group's name, or the organization's name, was Al-Qaeda in Iraq. The thing to keep in mind is the Al-Qaeda organization is a network of various groups that do have a common ideology and common goals. The goals are to first make Europeans, Americans, Christians, Jews flee their country, get out of their country. That's why they're trying to kill Americans, especially in the armed forces, the CIA, really any American. They don't want Europeans, they don't want Christians, Jews, Americans in their country, which I think is understandable. There is a natural human nature resentment of any foreigner that invades their country and is patrolling their neighborhoods, their towns, their cities every day. Eventually, they start fighting back and killing and wounding your sons and daughters. That's one of their goals. But what they also want to do is reestablish what's called a caliphate. Think of it as an empire, if you will. And the last caliphate collapsed in 1918. That was the Ottoman Empire. That included both Syria, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Palestine, Israel, Jordan, Yemen, Kuwait, as well as Turkey. It was a huge empire that it had existed for hundreds of years. The reason why the empire collapsed is Turkey was on the side of the Central Powers that lost in World War I. So when you're on the wrong side in a world war, and they were up against, initially, the United Kingdom, France, Russia, so-called Allied powers were fighting Germany, the Austrian-Hungary, and Ottoman Empire. And that was the most deadly war in world history. Tens of millions, over 20 million, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. I think it was roughly around 22 million people were killed. Some were in the military, some were civilians. Most were predominantly military deaths, but you had millions of civilian deaths as well, and over 20 million people actually wounded, military casualty. Keep that in mind. What they're trying to do is create a caliphate that initially will consist of Syria and Iraq. And remember, they're Sunni Muslims, and they don't like Christians, they don't like Jews, they don't like people, the other branch of Islam, Shia. They certainly don't like Hindus, Buddhists. In essence, they don't like anyone that doesn't have the same religion. And if you don't pay a tax, an exorbitant tax, they kill you. They give you a chance to flee. If you're lucky, get out of the country. Otherwise, we're going to be forced to kill you. And people have to flee their homes, their livelihoods, become displaced persons, and flee to other parts of a country or other nation. That's what they're about, and that's what they're trying to do. They want also to establish a very strict form of Sharia law, religious law, and enforce it. Now, what they're engaged is called a violent jihad or an offensive jihad. It's a holy war against the infidels. They call Christians crusaders. Remember, this faith has been in existence around 1,500 years, and they've been killing each other throughout that period. It is a very much a totalitarian as well as supremacist movement, and they would like to spread Islam, Sunni Islam, across the world. That is their ultimate goal, is a world caliphate. They understand they can't do it overnight, or for that matter in decades or centuries, but their ultimate goal is this. But initially, they want control of the lands that traditionally Sunni Arabs have controlled, and that's who we're fighting. They formerly were called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and what happened is after the 4 years of a lot of deaths in terms of, you know, several thousand deaths in terms of U.S. military forces, President Bush changed the strategy to counterinsurgency and appointed General David Petraeus. Some would say the savior general that was in charge of writing the field manual on counterinsurgency. Now, there's one very, very important point to understand about counterinsurgency and why I don't recommend it for the United States. Counterinsurgencies take time. It usually takes a minimum, successful counterinsurgencies take a minimum of 10 years or longer to win the hearts and minds and get the trust of the people that are natives to that country. It is not a type of warfare or strategy where it's quick, easy, and cheap to do. It takes literally tens of thousands of, in terms of Iraq, probably 30 to 50,000. Who knows the exact number? But it would take that number and some supporting troops or supporting logistics, supply type support, to stay in country for 10, 20, 30 years. The problem is, with the exception of Germany, Japan, and South Korea, where wars were fought, we defeated both Japan and Germany in World War II, and there was a truce in the Korean War. With the exception of those, and those are the countries we still have a fair, you know, thousands of U.S. armed forces still there. And it works out good for those countries. Even though there's still some resentment, the resentment is there. People don't like foreigners occupying their country, even if they benefit, have economic benefits from it. So time is not on the side of any military general that pursues what's called a counterinsurgency war. That's the first thing you need to understand. And what we're trying to do is develop trust from the people in the neighborhoods where we have small, if you will, I don't want to say base, more like buildings where U.S. troops are, and they go on patrol in the neighborhoods. They begin to understand, talk to the people. And the reason why you do this is you need intelligence on who the insurgents are. Because an insurgency, typically, they're in the neighborhood. They're living there, eating, living, making bombs, preparing war plans, planting bombs, and fighting and shooting and killing Americans, as well as people that do not share their religious views. In this case, for example, the Shia. And initially what happened in Iraq is once we switched military strategies to what they call COIN or counterinsurgency, casualties, both deaths and wounded, went up. But over time, the violence in those neighborhoods from bombs started to go down. Why? The people began to trust the Americans and would provide them information as to where the insurgents were. And the U.S. military went after those insurgents, primarily al-Qaeda in Iraq, and killed a lot of them. And most of them fled into Syria. Now they're back. They're back. They're larger. They're smarter. They know what they're doing. They're experienced. And they know what happened when the United States was in Iraq. A lot of them got killed. They almost got wiped out. But because of the fact that you need to keep troops there for many, many, many years to truly have a successful strategy. And what you're doing, ladies and gentlemen, is nation building. You're developing the government institutions you need to establish stability, peace, the rule of law. That all takes time, especially in a nation such as Iraq that had been run as a dictatorship for many, many years. You're never, as far as I'm concerned, you're never in my lifetime or for the foreseeable future going to have a democracy or representative republic in Iraq. But that's what we're doing, and it worked militarily. Unfortunately, it didn't work politically because Maliki, who has since resigned, he was prime minister, was a Shiite Arab, had backers, though, from the Shias in Iran. And because of his leadership, as well as the Shia militia that were attacking the Sunnis in their neighborhoods, you had what the U.S. military forces were able to get some stability the moment they left at the direct orders of President Obama in 2011. It slowly but surely reverted back to the situation that the United States Armed Forces found it in the first 3 or 4 years. So the Sunnis, many Sunnis, are flocking, especially the young, to this so-called Islamic State. Because, let's face it, they want revenge on what happened to them and their families. So you're dealing with what's called a sectarian conflict. In this case, people of different religious sects are fighting and killing and wounding each other. Right now, in the predominantly Sunni areas, Anbar province in the west and in northern Iraq around Mosul, the Islamic State is winning, controlling a lot of territory both in Iraq, northern Iraq, central Iraq, as well as in Syria. They've captured a lot of military equipment, especially U.S. equipment, tanks, Humvees, artillery, ammunition, rocket-propelled grenades. And a lot of what they've captured, they've shipped back to Syria. Some they left, but a lot was shipped back to Syria. And now the Islamic State is expanding into Syria. Now remember, Syria, you have a civil war going on between the Assad regime. Remember, he's an Alawite, whose allies are Russia and Iran. And remember, Iran, the Iranian people are Persian, and most of them are Shia. Not all of them, but the majority are Shia. And they're supporting Assad, again, another brutal dictator, against, you have a civil war going on. They're fighting what's called the FSA and other groups, including called FN Nusra. That's they don't want to advertise it, but it's Al-Qaeda. And what you got to understand, the Islamic State, formerly ISIS, you're going to hear ISIS on television and radio. They've had a falling out, so they're fighting each another as well as fighting the Assad regime. And when you have a civil war going, what happens? Hundreds of thousands, really close to a million probably today, of people have fled their country into neighboring countries. They're displaced people. They're going to Jordan. They're going to Egypt, wherever they can get in, to avoid the civil war, because people get caught, when you get caught up in a civil war, both sides are trying to kill each other and destroy you. So many cities, many towns in Syria, the situation is not good. They're street fighting. They're each side is trying to kill each other. Virtually all civil wars are very, very brutal. People get executed on the spot. They get killed by snipers, as well as artillery, barrel bombs, you name it, it's going on. You don't want to visit Syria. You don't want to visit Iraq, especially if you're an American, especially if you're a Christian or Jew or European, because if you ever fall in the hands of these violent jihadis, they'll kill you. They'll try to get money for you first. They'll try to ransom you, and if the government or whoever they're asking the money does not come up with the money, you might find yourself on a YouTube video being beheaded, and it's not a pleasant experience, especially for your loved ones that are not there, watching you get murdered. And that's exactly what they did. And apparently it was a British citizen, and there's an estimated somewhere between 500 to 600 people just from Great Britain, the United Kingdom, that have gone to Syria and Iraq to join this jihadist, this terrorist group, Islamic State or ISIS, to fight in the war. Some of them are religious fanatics. Some of them are simply criminals. Others are mercenaries or former soldiers in Saddam's army or police force. They know what they're doing militarily, and it's clear what they want. They want a caliphate where Sharia law is strictly enforced. It's not very good for women, by the way. I need to say that. The question is, and I don't have much time to get to the answer, what do we do? What do you think President Obama is going to do? He's made repeatedly clear, especially since he now has withdrawn the U.S. Army, Marines, our armed forces from Iraq in 2011, even though many military advisors said you really need to have a force of at least 30 to 50,000 to provide air cover as well as armor and artillery cover and continuing training the Iraqi army as well as national police to keep the country stable. He ignored that advice. The reason he gave was simply that the Iraqi government, their parliament, would not pass a status of force agreement. And what that involves is if a U.S. serviceman or woman commits a crime in that country, usually they're tried in a military court, but the Iraqi government was not agreeing to that. They wanted to be tried in an Iraqi court. And President Obama wanted the Iraqi parliament to pass that, and they didn't. So he ordered the withdrawal. Usually that's something that can be, it doesn't have to have parliament to approve it. It's something that can be approved administratively. But that, in a nutshell, is the reason why he left. Now, he will say, the Iraqi government didn't want our troops there, so I pulled them out. And in essence, their problem now is they have to get along. And the former practices of admittedly biased Maliki, who was, again, Shia, he was replaced. We have a new prime minister. And he basically said, yeah, we'll supply you arms, maybe some training, but we're not going to fight your wars. You're going to have to treat each another right with respect, and we'll provide you support to defend yourselves against the Islamic State. Good luck. Because these people, the Iraqis, whether they're Sunni, Shia, Kurds, and other religious minorities, have been killing and fighting each other for hundreds of years. The killing goes on and on. Yes, there are periods of stability. And before, although Saddam Hussein was a Sunni, brutal dictator, you didn't have, for example, the car bombings going off literally every day in Baghdad. And that's before the surge started to get some results. And that's part of the insurgency where, because these guerrilla forces, and that's what they are, cannot really engage in a conventional war, they use terror tactic to go after their enemies, and that usually takes the form of bombs going off in marketplaces, in mosques, public places, as well as attacking, when we were there, our troops, as well as the Iraqi government the buildings, their army, their police force. So we left. The president ordered our troops out. Any gains we had through the counterinsurgency process after 3 years are now gone. All that blood, sweat, and tears and some military success was blown, and largely by the current under Maliki, the prime minister, because he didn't particularly like Sunni. And there was a lot of animosity between the Shias and the Sunni. And what do we have now? A lot of young Sunnis are flocking to that black flag of the Islamic State. Some are volunteers. Many are simply being coerced into joining the Islamic State. What should the United States do? Now, I say don't go in again. Do not intervene in Iraq. What I mean by that is I more or less agree with President Obama, and I seldom do agree. And the reason I agree is the American people are sick of war. They are sick of the cost of war. And they are truly sick of seeing their sons and daughters be killed and wounded in Iraq. And when we leave, it just gets slowly but surely worse. Been there, done that, we're not going back. Now, President Obama, especially up until the election, November 4th, first Tuesday in November, he is not going to send regular army or reserve army, air force, marines into Iraq. It's not going to happen, folks. Politically, that would be suicide for President Obama. So I agree with his non-interventionist tendencies. He's strictly doing it. He's playing to his political base, the leftists in this country, the pacifists in this country, that didn't want the United States to go to war in Iraq when President Bush was president. And they certainly do not want the person they got elected president, who said he would withdraw the troops and eventually did withdraw the troops. They do not want to go back to Iraq. And I believe that is the majority opinion, public opinion of the American people. We're sick of war. Now, that said, what do I think is going to happen? I think that President Obama has been tempted by the use of covert Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, operatives, agents, operating in countries around the world, in this case, Iraq, as well as the use of so-called special operators, most of who are not, they were former special operating forces. Now they've retired or left the service. They're hired by the CIA. Used primarily to gather intelligence, but also to train our allies. Now, who do you think that should be? I have no doubts that we are today helping in Iraq the Kurdish. Remember, the three principal population groups are the Kurds in several provinces in northern Iraq, in the mountainous region on east, northeast, and they've been in the news. They are getting small arms, ammunition, support, as well as some training and intelligence from our Central Intelligence Agency, CIA agents and operatives, special operatives. In other words, former SEALs, special forces that have left the service and now are providing support. There are some military, not very many, several hundred, providing some security at our command centers and council in Erbil, the capital of Kurdistan. And I think the amount of arms, ammunition, weapons will increase to Kurdistan. And for all practical matters, this Kurdistan has become a protectorate, if you will, of the United States. And what we're primarily doing is using drones, unmanned aircraft that are controlled remotely, probably from Turkey or someplace in the Middle East, primarily Turkey, though, I think. And that's a guess on my part. These drones carry missiles, and they can be used and have been used to attack the Islamic State military forces that were pressing in on Kurdistan and the capital, Erbil. They have been, to a certain extent, having to pull back because the combination of the Kurdistan military as well as these drones have pushed out from Kurdistan and are making some progress. In addition, we have Navy F-18 fighters, Hornets, off the aircraft carrier George Bush that are also attacking various military targets of the Islamic State. But those jets have primarily been used to protect humanitarian efforts, relief efforts, providing aid and various supplies, food, water, clothing, tents, to the people that have been fleeing the Islamic State. So today, that's roughly what's going on. And as of yesterday, the United States had conducted approximately 90 airstrikes, both by jet fighters and drones. You can contain the Islamic State using those military tactics, combination of drones, aircraft, as well as boots on the ground, in this case, Kurds, but also in conjunction with support from on high from our aircraft or drones. But the problem is, and here is the problem, in an insurgency, yeah, you can kill the military forces of the Islamic State if they're in the open roads, you know, going between towns. These drones can spot them, launch their missiles, and kill them. But once the United States steps up its conventional warfare, in other words, more missions, sorties, if you will, what's going to happen? And it always happens. the insurgents, the people that are in this Islamic State's army, are going to disperse amongst the people in the towns, in the cities. It makes just like what Hamas is doing against Israel in the Gaza Strip, launching rockets from homes, schools. That is what happens when you're up against an insurgency. You literally have to go in there and root them out and kill them. That takes boots on the ground, if you will, military forces. And it's clear that Barack Obama has taken that off the table. Now, that does not mean he might find other nations' military forces to do the dirty work, to do that effort. But that's what it's going to take. You're going to have some form of a counterinsurgency strategy. You're going to have to kill them. You have to go in there and do it. You can't do it simply by drones and jet aircraft fighters and bombers. You can contain them that way. You can stop major thrust, if you will. But you can't destroy them, because once you step up the number of missions you're conducting, what do you think the enemy is going to do? They're going to pull back, disperse amongst the people. And that makes the mission, you can't accomplish it by jet fighters or bombers unless you're willing to kill a lot of innocent civilians. And then when you combine that with the president's statements, it's time for the Sunnis and Shias to make up, be nice to each other, play nice, and stand up to the Islamic State. Well, good luck. That's not going to work. You can wait way past when he will be history before that's going to happen. But what I see happening in Iraq is you'll see more support given, more support, more training, more arms given to the Kurdish people. And eventually, I see the split up of Iraq into three, probably four nations, namely Kurdistan in the north, certain eastern, southern areas will be controlled by the Shia, and then where the Sunnis predominate, you'll have the Islamic State, and you'll have a fourth country. Some will say only three. I think you're going to see four. One where the Shia, where it's virtually totally Shia, another section where it's totally Sunni, initially controlled by the Islamic State. You'll have the Kurds in the north, and you're going to have Baghdad and certain larger cities where you have a mixed population of both Shia and Sunnis. Call it core Baghdad, and then separate Shia region, separate Sunni. For example, Anbar province would be the Sunni area, and then Kurdistan. In other words, you're going to see the breakup of Iraq. And remember, Iraq is a country that France and Great Britain, as a result of World War I, drew on a map. Because where the Sunni live, the Shia live, and the Kurds live, they've been there for decades. Now, admittedly, the Kurds had to flee to the mountain. So that's what I think is going to happen. Now, what's going to be the strategy? What I hope the president does is not intervene in Iraq. In other words, very, very limited support, mainly confined to providing supplies, armaments, as well as using the CIA and contract personnel, former special operators to train the Kurds. And if some progress is made or it's needed to provide air cover, you'll probably get a little bit more of that. But it's going to take not weeks, not months. It'll take years, and we're right back to where we were with the surge. Because any successful counterinsurgency strategy takes decades. And Barack Obama will not be president in 2017. Then we'll have another president from another party. Now, here's the problem. You have Republicans, namely neocons, that are beating the war drums again. There are people in this country that want us to go back to Iraq and kill the Islamic State militants. They need killing, but who's going to do the killing? Some of it can be done by the air, but the only way you're ultimately going to need to go into those cities and towns and destroy them, kill them, just like we did during the surge under General Petraeus. And I agree with President Obama that that is going to be the job of the Kurds, the Shia, and the Sunni tribes when they finally wake up to the fact that this Islamic State is being brutal to their own people. And that's what will happen. How long it will take, this will probably stretch out for years. Because this Islamic State is very, very dangerous. It's well-funded. It's well-armed. They're experienced fighters. They can engage in a conventional war. They certainly will engage in an insurgency war. And they have no remorse in engaging in terrorist acts. In other words, the killing that has gone on in the Middle East, in Iraq, Syria, will continue for decades. Now, what makes this whole situation explosive? Should, for example, the Islamic State be successful against the Shia, expect Iran to intervene to protect the Shia. So that's element. And we're no friend. The United States has been at war through proxies with Iran for 35 years. They are no friends of ours. But that could happen if the Shia's back is to the wall. Now, but keep in mind, the Iranians are Persian and the Iraqis are Arab, even though they share the same religion as Shia, but they hate each other. You have nationalists. But if you have Sunnis that want to kill you and your back is to the wall, you'll go to the Iranians who are Shia for help. I think that will be a last resort. I hope it doesn't come to that. And I think there's a certain amount of coordination already going on between the United States and Iran in trying to bust support the Iraqi government against the Islamic State. I'm looking at the time. I'm going to have to wrap up the show. One other point. The U.S. Army, the generals, they never like special forces, elite forces. And they really do not like the counterinsurgency strategy, mainly because it bogs down large number of troops. It takes forever, and the American people really don't support it. So counterinsurgency, usually shortened to the acronym COIN, is really on the out in Washington, D.C. Not that it didn't work. It's just no one wants to commit U.S. troops for 10, 20, 30 years to really get it to work. And it's not just militarily. You need to make it work politically. And that requires the cooperation of the Shia and the Sunni, and they don't play well together. So that is my take, my comments, my opinions on the current situation in the Iraq-Syria area in terms of the Islamic State and what I think President Obama will do, again, mostly after the election. Up until then, yeah, there'll be some missions, drone primarily, killing certain Islamic State militants. Occasionally, some jet fighters will be launched. But don't expect any U.S. troops, or what Obama says, boots on the ground, to go back into Iraq. He's totally against it, primarily for political reasons. And he doesn't believe it works. And he said very clearly, I call this the Obama doctrine, don't do stupid things. And what he's referring to, he thinks the decision by President Bush to go in Iraq was a stupid thing to do. That's his opinion. But when he pulled out the troops from Iraq, any advantage or the benefits of the surge quickly dissipated, in this case 3 years. And guess what? Al-Qaeda is back, and now it's a terrorist army, a well-funded army, and they call themselves the Islamic State. Let's pray for the United States and the people of Iraq that are facing these killers. Now let me end my show with America the Beautiful. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own unless otherwise stated and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. Good evening, and welcome back, returning students, because the first day of the fall semester is this Monday. Have a great weekend, and welcome new students, the freshman class, both at Richland College and the Richland College High School. Have a great weekend. Good night.